arguably the world's most famous businessman, wore his heart on his sleeve at a big shale conference.
Oh, you will like me so much. You will get that business.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump woos the oil and gas industry. But is the feeling mutual? Plus, the protest to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline feels like deja vu for some Native Americans.
It's the same fight. This one just called more attention.
And we look at a sizzling new piece of public art that has one Pittsburgh neighborhood rethinking an old problem.
We look at the vacant lots in our community as assets, not as blight.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. On Thursday, Donald Trump told an oil and gas industry conference that if elected, he'd unleash America's fossil fuel sector. More fracking, more drilling, and fewer regulations. But the oil and gas industry has shown less commitment to Trump than it has previous Republican candidates. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that's because Trump is a Republican of a different stripe.
At the David L. Lawrence Convention Center in Pittsburgh, Donald J. Trump introduced himself to the crowd of oil and gas executives with a promise.
It's great to be with so many of my friends. Oh, you will like me so much. You will get that business.
The fracking industry has made Pennsylvania the number two natural gas producing state in the U.S., behind Texas. And Trump gave the audience, many of whom took part in the fracking boom here, a campaign promise of fewer environmental rules and more help building pipelines and other big energy projects.
I'm going to lift the restrictions on American energy and allow this wealth to pour into our communities, including right here in the state of Pennsylvania that we love.
The oil and gas industry typically favors the GOP, the party of small government and fewer regulations, but Trump may have some work to do to tie down support from oil and gas. Hillary Clinton is actually raising more campaign donations from the industry than Trump is right now. Jeff Maurer is editor at America's Oil News and Analysis. He says some in the industry are leery of Trump, especially when it comes to his command of policy details. He recently came out in favor of an ethanol policy some refiners oppose. A few hours after Trump's position was posted on his website, the campaign took it down.
They think Trump is speaking in these broad generalities, and then when he does get specific, he'll pull back on it. So it's very hard to gauge, I suppose, what exactly Trump will do going forward.
That's not such a great quality, especially for an industry that craves predictability in its political allies, Maurer says. Still, many in the oil and gas industry view Trump, with all his obvious flaws, as a better choice than Clinton for their industry. Michael Hines works for a West Virginia engineering firm that serves the fracking industry. He was working a booth on the floor of the convention center where Trump spoke.
I do think that his heart is in the right place. I think that he wants to do things that remove the barriers from making our country work better. And I feel like, you know, we're past due. We're overdue for that.
Hines says he doesn't trust Clinton, citing scandals over Benghazi and her questionable use of a private email server. Still, Hines says he wants to see a little more out of Trump.
I'm a Republican. I've voted Republican my whole life. I'm working my way toward Trump. I'm not there yet, but he's got to start acting a little more presidential.
He was heartened by the fact that oil billionaire Harold Hamm was advising Trump on energy issues. Hamm recently had to clear up one of Trump's positions on fracking when Trump told a news reporter he'd be okay with local fracking bans. These bans are vigorously opposed by the oil and gas industry. Hamm later had to say that Trump didn't, quote, understand the issue when he had first answered the question. It's moments like that one that give John Becker pause about voting for Trump.
He's his own worst enemy. I think this might not even be a race if Trump and his team could somehow prevent him from stepping on his own feet all the time.
Becker works for a fracking equipment supplier in Ohio. He thinks Trump picks unnecessary fights, like the time he attacked the family of a soldier killed in Iraq. So who is Becker voting for?
I'm leaning toward Gary Johnson, actually.
Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate. So given the choice between Trump and Clinton, Becker says he will take C, none of the above. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Researchers in West Virginia and Kansas want to get a better handle on how to manage the billions of gallons of wastewater produced across the United States by the oil and gas industry. Glynis Board has more.
Kansas University and West Virginia University just announced a joint research effort to identify safe, environmentally responsible management of the wastewater that's a byproduct of natural gas wells. Researchers from the two universities acquired a $4 million grant from the National Science Foundation, in part to study the effects of drilling on surface water.
So you have three classes of potential contaminants. You have salts, organic compounds, and some amount of radioactivity, mainly in the form of radium.
That's one of the lead researchers with the project, director of West Virginia's Water Research Institute, Paul Zimkevich. He says management of wastewater, sometimes called produced water, is a growing concern.
A lot of the produced water that was generated over the first wave of Marcellus development was largely being consumed in new well completions. And with the drop in gas prices, well completions have gone down, and therefore we have this extra water accumulating that we need to find something, well, we need to find a way to dispose of it, treat it, use it, or something else.
He says researchers also hope to develop safe handling and treatment practices of the wastewater, as well as develop ways to avoid earthquakes when disposing the wastewater into underground injection wells. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Public art is usually free. It's accessible, and it can take many shapes.
At first, I didn't know what it was till I saw the last part of the bun, and it had the little, I was like, oh, that's a hamburger. Oh, yeah.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a community is flipping the problem of vacant lots with a giant sandwich sculpture. Stay tuned to find out if there's special sauce. More than a month after construction began on a controversial stretch of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the front line of the fight is filled with faces from Alaska to Florida. As Inside Energy's Amy Sisk reports, for many camped on the North Dakota prairie, the fight feels familiar.
It's a short walk from the central fire where people converge to hear prayer and song to the place where the Sami family set up camp.
My dad brought a good tent.
That's Tiwani Sami. He points inside to their two beds, some boots, a space heater. Outside, it's a sea of people living just like them along the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri rivers. They're here for one reason, the water. Less than a mile north is the epicenter of the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's the spot where the line, capable of carrying half of North Dakota's daily oil production, would cross under the Missouri River, if construction is ever completed. Tiwani and his dad, Quiltman, traveled 1,300 miles from Oregon to join the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its fight to stop that construction. Tribal members here are concerned sacred sites have already been destroyed and a potential spill could poison the drinking water on the reservation downstream.
Everything needs that water. Everything, all life.
Quiltman grew up during a dispute over water used by his tribe in Oregon. In the 1950s, the Army Corps of Engineers dammed the Columbia River near his home on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation. For thousands of years, people fished the falls on that river, forming a community and economic hub. Tribes from the Great Plains traveled there to sell buffalo meat and hide.
That was probably the biggest trading center in this country right there.
But, Quiltman says, when the Corps dammed up the river...
You know, it changed the lives of all of our people.
Fast forward to today. His tribe's latest fight, once again, it's over water. The Oxbow Springs, north of that same reservation in Oregon. Nestle, the global food company, wants to bottle that water.
It's the same fight. This one just called more attention.
Indigenous people have a long history opposing energy development and infrastructure projects they say threaten their environment. Those fights, including the one today, raise questions about sovereignty, about tribes' rights to have a say in managing their land. Brian Cladisby is president of the National Congress of American Indians, a Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group for tribes' rights.
Just about every tribe has horror stories of the government allowing companies and corporations to, at will, destroy these sacred sites.
From environmental problems in Alaska after the Exxon Valdez oil spill to coal mining on ancestral land, these stories are shared widely at the camps here in North Dakota. Johanna Holy Elkface sits near the central fire listening to music. She was born here on Standing Rock, but now lives in Denver. She tells me the story about her sister who lives on the Navajo Reservation in the southwestern United States.
Their water looks horrible, though. It's like yellow clay.
She's referring to the Gold King mine spill. Contractors working at the abandoned mine in Colorado last year unintentionally caused 3 million gallons of wastewater to leak into the nearby river, which then flowed through New Mexico and Utah. Last month, the Navajo Nation sued the Environmental Protection Agency over its response to the disaster. Cyrus Norcross of the Navajo Nation is used to seeing tribes fight and ultimately lose. But here, the Dakota Access protest...
And it kept getting bigger and bigger, and next thing you know, I was like, I think these guys might actually win.
Earlier this month, three federal agencies announced they would block construction of the pipeline for now at the Missouri River crossing while re-examining their permitting decisions. There's talk that this is a turning point for indigenous people. Here's Cladisby with the National Congress of American Indians.
We are showing the world that this is not going to be business as usual going forward.
The Dakota Access Pipeline developer, Energy Transfer Partners, said in a statement that concerns about the pipeline's impact on the local water supply are unfounded and that it was designed with, quote, tremendous safety factors. Construction on the 1,200-mile project is 60% complete. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
That story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration that focuses on America's energy issues. The ramifications of the Obama administration's recent decision to halt construction on the Dakota Access oil pipeline are being felt outside of North Dakota. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports that the oil and gas industry is concerned about the growing public opposition to pipelines.
These projects have become front and center in a battle over the nation's energy future and global climate change. Gary Heminger is the CEO of Marathon Petroleum and is one of the industry executives gathering in Pittsburgh for the annual Shale Insight Trade Conference. He calls pipeline opponents a major challenge.
Despite the obvious truth that we make modern life possible, some activists try to portray fossil fuels and the companies that produce, transport, and sell them as villains.
The industry says pipelines help secure the nation's domestic energy supply, noting more gas pipelines are particularly needed as coal plants retire, causing gas to take up a larger share of electric power generation. But in Pennsylvania, many communities have formed local opposition groups to challenge pipeline projects. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Activists across Pennsylvania are voicing their concerns about the Dakota Access Pipeline. In one recent protest, about 150 people rallied in downtown Pittsburgh to support the Standing Rock Sioux and others trying to permanently stop construction. The protesters held a long banner reading, "Stop the Pipeline," across Liberty Avenue, closing the street to traffic for about 20 minutes before moving to the sidewalk. The Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant walked up as Casey Powers was taking the megaphone. She lives in Salem Township, site of a recent pipeline explosion.
Our right to clean air, clean water, and clean living is more important than any pipeline. Protect the people first. We all must be in solidarity for Standing Rock.
Yes. Yes. So we are going to move back to the sidewalk. The police have said that they will start arresting us if we don't. So we're going to move back. And as we go back to the sidewalk, let's say, Standing with Standing Rock. Standing with Standing Rock.
Standing with Standing Rock.
Oh, I'm Leah Solomon. I'm a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh. Native Americans were the first people here, you know, and now they're calling them trespassers. How can you call them trespassers? We're the trespassers, you know? Like, they're protecting the land. They've been protecting the land since we came here and took it over. And it's about time everyone stood up for them.
My name's David Smith, and I'm from Fort Berthel Reservation, Prairie Chicken Clan. But here, live in Pittsburgh, you know, this is not an Indian thing, it's a human thing, and we're trying to get that across to people, give that message that this affects all of us, not just the Indian peoples. You know, pipelines break, they explode, they pollute. You know, they make all these promises that the pipeline's going to be safe, but they've proven that their words are empty, so their promises are empty.
Today was an act of solidarity with the folks out in North Dakota, right? We were coming together to show our solidarity, but it doesn't end there. This is just the beginning. There are many ways that folks here in Pittsburgh can support what's going on in North Dakota.
This is only one shot we got at this Mother Earth, and she's very sick. So keep up the good work. All you young people, I really appreciate you being activists. There's no such thing as being an activist, you know. You're just being a good human being, sticking up for your planet. So keep up the good work.
That was Johnny Coe of Verona, near Pittsburgh. His son is among those who've joined the Standing Rock Sioux Nation in North Dakota in opposition to the pipeline. And earlier, we heard from Eva Westheimer with Three Rivers Rising Tide, which helped organize the demonstration. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant captured the action. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Walking along a side street in Pittsburgh's north side neighborhood of Deutschtown, you might run into a giant cheeseburger the size of a camper van. It's not a mirage, it's public art.
So she created this out of recycled materials. The green lettuce that you're seeing is a prior work that she had created that she repurposed for this.
That's Lee Parker, founder of Neukirche, a nearby community art center focused on women artists. She's pointing out the yarn and fabric that's been painted green and looks a little wilty under the big wooden bun. Parker's giving a tour of pieces in Neukirche's Fallow Grounds for Sculpture Summer Residency Program. That's where art is created to inhabit vacant lots. The artist who made the cheeseburger, Amy Masters, is from Pittsburgh, Kansas, where she says roadside attractions bring communities together and help rejuvenate the economy of small towns. You have to get up close to this not-so-juicy burger to see what's really going on.
The tires were the tough part. She had to break those down, cut them up, and bolt them on, but they're the meat of the sandwich.
And then there are more fixins: purple onion slices made from plumbing tubing, and red tomatoes a foot wide. Parker says artists in the Fallow Grounds program are interested in recycled materials in the community and the environment.
We look at the vacant lots in our community as assets, not as blight. So the people across the street here that own the vending machine business donated this lot to us for the summer.
This and the other two Fallow Grounds lots are owned by people in the neighborhood or the city. This Northside roadside attraction will be here until the end of October, unless the community decides to keep it.
At first, I didn't know what it was until I saw the last part of the bun, yeah. And it had the little, I was like, oh, that's a hamburger. Oh, yeah.
Shadonna Preston's waiting on a bus nearby. She lives just around the corner with her daughter, Destiny.
When I was walking home from school, I always see them build it, like they were starting up from fresh.
They both think the burger is pretty cool.
I think it's great. I really did. I think it's interesting.
But Preston says for her, vacant lots aren't a big problem.
No, because I like the people I live around, so.
She says public art could help bring attention to the neighborhood, though, and get people talking. Lee Parker says community members engage with the artists during their residency and even help build the sculptures. And drivers on busy Chestnut Street?
People would just sit and watch and look at this and wonder what's going on. Or stop and get their photo taken with it.
Parker says the cheeseburger sculpture invites people to take another look at the potential for the vacant lot and what's underneath.
It's hard to look around this neighborhood and not consider the environmental issues that reside here.
A house was recently demolished on the site.
We spend a lot of time cleaning up, raking, getting rid of glass.
And working outside in this urban landscape is also a challenge for the artists, as well as residents.
Our neighborhood doesn't have a lot of trees. We have a lot of concrete, and we're in one of the biggest heat zones in the city.
Parker says a giant all-rubber patty on a painted sesame seed bun also helps lighten up the heavy topics around vacant properties. Some of the people on the tour certainly thought so.
This would be a nice spot for a Rubens.
A Rubens?
Okay.
Just saying.
All right, you're putting your hand up. Yeah, to create a Rubens.
I think that's
a great idea.
The tour was part of Pittsburgh's Renew Festival of repurposed materials and sustainability. And you can learn more about that at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. But let's stay with vacant lots and blighted properties. Courtney Linder looked into some of these issues in Pittsburgh in a three-part series for Public Source. That's our investigative news partner. And she joins me now. Courtney, we just heard about this project putting public art in vacant lots on Pittsburgh's north side to help facilitate conversations about the neighborhood. Did you talk to anyone in the north side about blight there?
Yeah, so the person that I had the most contact with is definitely Mark Masterson, who is the Northside Community Development Fund executive director. He kind of took me on this guided tour around all the neighborhoods in the north side, which a lot of people tend to think of the north side just as this one community. They don't realize that there's all these separate spots within it. And I thought, out of all of the things that I wrote about, some of the things that didn't make it in were about vacant lots. And one of the things he had said was that in the Observatory Hill neighborhood, they wanted to work on a hops yard in one of the vacant lots to kind of provide local breweries with Pittsburgh-grown hops. So I thought that was a pretty cool idea. He talked with me a good bit about other ways that we can kind of work on this vacant lot issue, and the main one being the side yard program. You can basically purchase any adjoining lot to your property that's city-owned and cannot have a structure built on it for really cheap, actually. I think $250 is the minimum bidding. And you can create pretty much anything out of it. You can turn it into a parking pad. You can make it into green space. A lot of people have been utilizing that. And I think that's a really great way to take something that is basically useless. You know, there's these overgrown patches all over the place that are kind of making communities disjointed. You walk around and it's kind of like a little girl with a toothless grin after she lost her teeth. There's houses here and there, and then you see these lots, and you're like, what used to be here? Was there a house fire? We don't know. But instead, you see people creating installation art, vegetable gardens. There's also some neighborhoods that do, like, rain barrels, rain collection. But it's better to have a vacant lot that's being used for something than a vacant building that's just collapsing, unless you can repair it somehow and you can kind of salvage it, gutting the inside. And that's what I sort of talk about in that preservation piece, is like, you know, there is this line between can we save this building, can we not? And that's what's so hard to determine.
What did you learn about some of the issues around vacant lots and blight? And why is it such a problem in our region?
It's definitely a giant financial burden, first off, because whenever there's vacant lots, most of them are tax delinquent. The city can't maintain them either. It's a giant eyesore. So property values for neighboring buildings plummet. You see that and you're like, oh, I don't really want to move in next to this vacant lot. Instead of seeing them as a complete burden, we should see them as an opportunity, I think. And that's what I've seen a lot with community development groups. And the one piece that I wrote, Lena Andrews was the head of this community group in East Liberty that turned the spot that used to have a building on it probably about 40 to 50 years ago that was just kind of having trash thrown on it everywhere and turned it into this kind of community area where they can walk their dogs. And it's sort of this archway into the neighborhood now, whereas before it wasn't really serving any purpose. And I think that vacant lots are such an issue in Pittsburgh because there's so many of them. There's something like 27,000, I think, in Allegheny County, 9,000 in the city. And that just sort of speaks to this massive exodus of people that left in the last 60 years since the steel industry collapse. And it's like $595 to maintain each lot, and clearly the city isn't able to do that.
So what are some of the other ways that communities are addressing blight? I know that you did a piece about land banking. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
To back up a little bit, I think we need to understand why we need a land bank. It's a really lengthy process to try to acquire buildings that are tax delinquent, essentially. And a land bank can kind of facilitate this process. Say that you have a community group. I talked to the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation. They're trying to create this sort of Garfield Park with vacant buildings, blighted buildings that are an eyesore to the community. They're dangerous. You know, they could be fire hazards and adjoining vacant lots. They want to acquire some of these properties, but some of them are privately owned by people who might not even live here anymore. Some of them are owned by the housing authority. But the bottom line is that the properties that they can acquire, they have to take to a treasury sale. And whenever they do that, anybody could outbid them. With a land bank in place, it could speed up the process and guarantee that they get the properties that they want. This land bank out east, the Tri-Cog Land Bank, that one just got signed on over the summer. Allegheny County approved it. Each municipality, school district for the municipality, and then the county overall needs to approve of this land bank for it to actually acquire any properties in those areas. So take North Braddock, for example. North Braddock is one of those communities. Now, if you have a vacant lot or a vacant property, the land bank might say, okay, there's this strip of buildings that aren't really doing much for us, and we want to acquire those and turn it into something. They'll have like a small project in mind. So that's kind of the value of a land bank.
I feel like your articles are very hopeful and they're all about solutions. And they're also community oriented, like the people who live there are really taking this on.
Yeah, and that's one thing that Mark and I had talked about a lot whenever I was touring the north side with him is that, you know, these large scale projects that the city could fund, it isn't really going to fix the problem. I think a lot of it needs to come from the ground up. Communities that kind of take ownership of the area sort of create this really nice butterfly effect where you see if somebody, you know, participates in this side yard sale program and fixes up a lot next to their home, they buy it for really cheap. And then not only have they expanded their property and done something nice with it, but they've inspired people around them to probably want to do the same. I mean, people live everywhere for a reason. There needs to be something keeping people in their communities. And I think one thing is obviously having a nice place to live and looking around and being proud of what you see around you. And another one is feeling like you're a part of a community.
Well, thank you, Courtney.
Thanks for having me.
Courtney Linder looked into issues around blight and vacant properties for Public Source. That's our investigative news partner. You can read her stories at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.